Coming up, novelist Jodi Picoult turning ethical dilemmas into bestsellers.
I'm not going to tell a person how to think. I don't believe in that.
Also, Benedictine monks in Minnesota discovering and preserving the texts of India's earliest Christians, who many believe were converted by the Apostle Thomas in the first century. And this week of Holocaust Remembrance Day, the Catholic priest who has interviewed the aging witnesses to the Nazi genocide in Ukraine.
And suddenly, I discovered it was an extermination, not camp, but a continent of extermination.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics Newsweekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week, the world marked Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, the annual memorial for those killed by the Nazis. In Israel, as a siren sounded, people stood still for 2 minutes to remember those who died. In Poland, thousands joined the annual March of the Living at the site of the Auschwitz concentration camp. Here in the U.S., President Barack Obama attended a Holocaust remembrance ceremony at the Capitol. Tension over the Holocaust threatened to derail the United Nations Conference on Racism and Intolerance in Geneva. In a controversial speech, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad called the Holocaust a, quote, pretext for aggression against Palestine. His comments prompted delegates from more than a dozen countries to walk out. Representatives from the Vatican stayed, but a church spokesman called Ahmadinejad's comments extremist and unacceptable. The U.S. had boycotted the meeting out of concern that it would provide a platform for critics of Israel. Leaders of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America joined others in lobbying for the release of an American freelance journalist imprisoned in Iran. 31-year-old Roxana Saberi was sentenced to 8 years in prison on charges of spying for the U.S. Saberi is a graduate of Concordia College, an ELCA school in Minnesota, and was scheduled to deliver the commencement address there next weekend. Iranian authorities arrested her in January. Muslims in this country say the FBI is spying on them. A federal judge in California has ordered the FBI to turn over documents about its surveillance of Muslim activists, which included planting an FBI informant inside a local Islamic center. Meanwhile, Muslims in Michigan have asked Attorney General Eric Holder to investigate reports that the FBI is spying on mosques there. President Obama signed a $5.7 billion national service bill into law. The measure is intended to bolster community volunteer efforts. The new law will also triple the size of the AmeriCorps service program, which helps local charitable projects. A judge in New York denied a request to stop the installation of the senior minister at the prominent Riverside Church in Manhattan. Reverend Brad Braxton is being installed as the church's new leader this weekend, but some parishioners object. They say they would not have supported Braxton had they known the details of his annual salary and other compensation, reportedly worth more than $600,000. But the head of the Riverside Church Council said that is in line with the pay of leaders of other big congregations in New York. Economic burdens may force the nation's oldest Reform Jewish educational institution to close two of its three campuses in the U.S. The president of the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion said a projected $8 million deficit threatens the future of campuses in Cincinnati, New York, and Los Angeles, although no final decisions have been made. A campus in Jerusalem apparently will be spared. As Mexico continues to fight spiraling drug violence, priests in the predominantly Catholic country are increasingly under threat. Members of the Mexican Bishops' Conference this week urged priests speaking out against the drug traffickers to, quote, assume an attitude of caution while maintaining their opposition to the drug trade. This coming June, Hollywood releases a major motion picture dealing with a difficult ethical issue, genetic engineering. It's based on one of the novels of Jodi Picoult, who creates bestsellers out of tough moral choices. Bob Faugh has the story.
Squirreled away in her New Hampshire farmhouse and writing at a feverish pace, Jodi Picoult does more than churn out best-selling novels on gut-wrenching moral dilemmas. She also forces her readers to think, even squirm.
I'm not going to tell a person how to think. I don't believe in that. What I want to do when I write these books is just to say, don't be so sure of yourself. Let me pull that carpet out from underneath you and let's see if you still can find the footing.
She has done that in each of her 16 books, which have sold over 15 million copies. Some so provocative with so many twists and turns, they've been turned into films. Next month, Hollywood releases her My Sister's Keeper, which explores the implications of genetic engineering.
Most babies are accidents. Not me. I was engineered. Born to save my sister's life.
What happens, Picoult asked, when the child conceived to help save her sister decides that she doesn't want to?
What's going on? Anna, you're suing us?
I don't want to do it anymore, Mom. It's my body. I want to be able to make my own decisions about what to do with it.
You may read that book and say it is morally wrong to conceive a child to save the life of another sick child. But if I put you on, you know, underneath the microscope, if I point a finger at you and say you are in that situation, can you honestly tell me as a parent that you would not do anything you had to save the life of your child? I really defy you to be able to say that you would not do it too.
Picoult chooses contemporary topics like that, often ripped from the headlines. For example, examining the death penalty in Change of Heart. After the tragedy at Columbine, she wrote 19 Minutes, which focuses not only on bullying, but on the moral dilemma of parents whose son has, as at Columbine, gunned down 10 of his classmates.
Can you be a good parent and still wind up with a child that commits a horrific act? And if your child does that, how can you love a child that does that? If you're a good parent, how can you not love him?
What has to resonate with you before you embark on a topic?
It has to be something that I'm usually worried about, something that keeps me up at night. It's the thing that's like the splinter in your brain that won't go away, that you keep circling back to over and over. I keep thinking about it and asking myself questions like, what would you do in that situation? Or what if this parameter had changed? And I keep thinking about that. I know it's going to be a great idea for a book.
In The Tenth Circle, Picoult explores the moral choices facing a teenager living in a culture of sexuality and drugs. Her latest book, Handle with Care, which is already at the top of the charts, centers around a 5-year-old girl, Willow, who has a severe disability.
The family has found, like many other families who are struggling to raise a child with a disability, that money is a big problem because there's not a lot out there in terms of insurance or funding. And that's sort of the situation that we walk into when Handle with Care opens. Pick 10 strangers and stick them in a room and ask them which one of us they feel sorrier for, you or me.
The girl has osteogenesis imperfecta, leaving her with bones so brittle she will have thousands of breaks during her lifetime. To pay for her care, her mother files a wrongful birth suit against her obstetrician, who is also the mother's best friend.
I think many of my books, including Handle with Care, including My Sister's Keeper, circle back to how far are we willing to go for the people we love. I think love changes the way we think. It's the thing that takes you out of what your normal set of beliefs would be.
Picoult does extensive research for each book, visiting the Rhode Island Crime Lab for an upcoming novel, spending time on death row for Change of Heart, or staying on an Amish farm for plain truth. What sets her apart isn't just the research and her painstaking attention to detail. What also sets her apart is her refusal to take the easy way out.
This is from Vanishing Acts. At the very end, the daughter, "My mother and father are both right, and at the same time, they are both wrong."
Mm-hmm. And I think that's totally possible. And I do believe very often, the closer we are to a person involved who's causing us to take these actions, the blurrier that line gets for us.
It's a willingness to grapple with all sides of a debate, which has won her an almost cult-like following. Sally Crouch and her daughter Beth drove 4 hours to see Pico at this Baltimore book signing.
Even though it seems like black and white, I think she writes it so you really don't know. She leaves it up to you to decide.
It's a sentiment echoed by many of her readers.
I think she just keeps her mind open to everything. Like, just, you know, if you have an opinion about one topic, then all of a sudden now you can see maybe somebody else's side of the story.
And Pico doesn't sugarcoat those issues. In her Plain Truth, for example, where an Amish teenager is charged with murdering her out-of-wedlock baby, an entire religious community is put on trial.
In fact, Katie Fitch is the first Amish person in this state to be charged with murder, ever. You know why? Because Amish people don't commit murder. Ever.
Pico's portrayal is harsh. Here, the villain is none other than a devout Amish mother.
I think that what I did was strip away the rose-colored glasses, because we have so idealized their existence, their simplicity of life, and, you know, their adherence to faith, that we're not seeing them very clearly. Their citizens run the gamut.
Religion, says Pico, has brought comfort and misery. She does not affiliate herself with any formal religion.
I do believe in God, though. And yet, I totally support the fact that there are people who do not believe in God. And I think that if you are Catholic, that's great. And I think if you're Protestant, that's great. And if you're Jewish, that's great. And I firmly believe that there is just not one way to do it.
Even though she forces her readers to think about the unthinkable, Pico says for herself she's never been happier in that New Hampshire home she shares with Delilah and Quigley, two miniature donkeys.
Even though I don't write about things that come from my life, because I'm lucky and I live in a great place with great kids and, you know, a great husband, I think you can find threads of me in the characters. And that's really what being a writer is, probably. It's being able to dilute something about you, just a tiny little dollop of it, into, you know, the heart or the soul of different characters. You are always bleeding a little piece of yourself into everybody.
Although some people of faith would say there is always a right or wrong side, for Pico, that choice is not so clear and can be agonizing to make.
Here are the things I know for sure. When you think you're right, you are most likely wrong.
When you think you're right, you are most likely wrong.
You might think you're on one side of it and find out you're actually on the other.
Agonizing choices in a confusing world. The ideal ingredients for a novelist and former teacher.
It's certainly my honor to be able to hopefully change the world a tiny bit, one mind at a time. If you can make them understand why someone with a differing opinion has that opinion and at least come to respect that opinion, I think you make the world a better place. I think I'm still teaching. It's just a really big classroom.
Jodi Pico delving into the moral complexities and ambiguities of modern life and helping her readers navigate where choices are rarely black and white, but what one of her characters calls a thousand shades of gray.
You're supposed to give her a kidney?
I want to see my parents for the rights to my own body.
Would you repeat that, please?
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Bob Faugh in Hanover, New Hampshire.
In southern India, in Kerala, there are millions of people known as St. Thomas Christians. Their ancestors, many believe, were converted by the Apostle Thomas in the first century. Portuguese missionaries later destroyed most of the ancient church writings, replacing them with their own. But now Benedictine monks at St. John's Abbey in Minnesota are rediscovering the surviving texts. Fred DeSam Lazaro has a close-up view of all this. He's both our correspondent and journalist in residence at St. John's University.
St. John's Abbey in Minnesota may be best known in the world of biblical manuscripts for its illuminated handwritten Bible.
Ethiopian manuscript, Latin manuscript.
But also here in the subterranean Hill Museum and Manuscript Library is one of the most extensive records of sacred texts from around the world.
This project of preserving manuscripts photographically was started out of our Benedictine tradition of being guardians of culture. The monasteries have been places where texts particularly have been treasured.
Father Columbus Stewart's quest to record church history, to fill in its blanks, has taken him to the farthest trails of early Christianity, to Turkey, Iraq, and perhaps the least well-known destination, Kerala, a province in southwestern India, where he recently brought a delegation of his museum's benefactors.
Well, we got to India through the Middle East, and of course that's how Christianity got to India in the first place. There's an assumption that there were no Christians in India until the Western missionaries brought the gospel to this land of pagans. And that's not the truth at all.
Long before it reached many parts of Europe, Christianity came across the Arabian Sea to Kerala along the thriving spice trade routes. Today, about 7 million people, a fifth of Kerala's population, call themselves St. Thomas Christians, after Jesus' apostle, who many here believe arrived in India in 52 AD. Even today, parts of some liturgies are sung in Syriac, close to the Aramaic language spoken by Christ.
They claim to have been converted by St. Thomas the Apostle. This we cannot prove either or disprove. But from the, I don't know, third, perhaps fourth century onwards, we have testimonies to their existence here.
Professor István Purcell, a Hungarian scholar of medieval Christianity, has championed the effort to document Kerala's church history, bringing together the Minnesota monastery and local Indian scholars.
We have never seen this.
He spent months in Kerala scouring dusty church closets for old texts and records.
Can we come back to digitize this?
Most of these go back only as far as the beginning of colonization, around the 15th century, when the first European colonists, the Portuguese, arrived to find both spices and the St. Thomas Christians, who they discovered were a distant branch of Middle Eastern Orthodox churches.
By their lights, viewing it through the lens of the 15th and 16th century European perspective, these people were heretics. They were concerned that their liturgy and their other writings be purified and corrected on the basis of what a Portuguese Latin Rite Roman Catholic would expect to be normative. So there is very, very little manuscript evidence from before the Portuguese era, because the Portuguese were very good at collecting these manuscripts that were they already found, destroying them and issuing corrected copies of them.
So, Father Ignatius, this is your oldest
Syriac
manuscript.
This is the oldest Syriac manuscript which I have here in these archives, which is written in 1563.
It's a Syriac manuscript, but there's a Latin note
that
this manuscript belonged to the Carmelites. And it's interesting that they write it in Latin. So that again tells you something about the religious situation.
Latin or Roman Catholic ways were introduced or imposed on the St. Thomas Christians, though Syriac continued in use in their liturgies. But many outlawed rites survived, as did factions that resisted, pledging loyalty to a Syriac patriarch instead of the Pope. Scribes from Kerala were later sent to the Middle East to recover texts destroyed by the Portuguese. The only surviving copies of many are now in Kerala.
Those are treasures, because we can find manuscripts that may have disappeared in Middle Eastern libraries, some collections of East Syrian canon law, for example, preserved in unique manuscripts in Kerala, which haven't survived because of the later persecution of these Christians in the Middle East in the 19th and 20th centuries.
The Kerala Church, meanwhile, has seen schisms both between and within the Western and Eastern branches, but through it all, the St. Thomas Christians have maintained a distinctly Indian, that is, non-European character.
We are Christian in faith, and we are Indian in citizenship. And we are Hindus in culture.
Father Ignatius Paiapilli started this museum a few years ago, collecting relics and statues mostly from demolished church buildings.
See the halo of Jesus around his head, and see the long ears and his hair. These are all typical resemblance of the statue of Buddha.
Although the Western scholars first came in search of Syriac manuscripts, they have also discovered a rich local history inscribed on palm leaves and in Malayalam, the local language, and tongues that preceded it. Much of it is everyday church accounts and records, valuable history to scholars, just clutter to most priests in the local churches.
And most of these palm leaves were, you know, either put in somewhere where you have them exposed to termites and mites, or just put up with logs and whatever is all the waste material. Sometimes they burn it up.
The palm leaves reveal a community that could serve as a model of interfaith harmony in a larger region that's often seen sectarian violence. The churches employed Hindu scribes, for example, and bishops enjoyed warm relations with the local kings who reigned in the area.
I have seen here in these archives a beautiful document written by the bishop, handwritten together with the printed one, requesting all the churches belonging to Cochin kingdom. They should celebrate the 60th birthday of the king.
There's still much to be analyzed, much to be discovered. All of it will be digitized, rescued from moisture, termites, and neglect, and stored here for scholars and for posterity. There will also be backup copies in an unlikely safe haven, a monastery in central Minnesota. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam-Lazaro.
Finally, this week of Holocaust Remembrance Day, the story of Father Patrick Desbois, a French Catholic priest whose grandfather's World War II legacy led to what became for Father Desbois a sacred mission to seek out the aging witnesses of the Nazi massacre of Jews in Ukraine. They told him what they had seen as children and what they had even been forced to assist with. Then they led him to the mass graves.
I began by Ukraine because in the beginning it was a private story. I wanted only to find back the memory of my grandfather and also where were the corpses of the Jews and to bury them with dignity. And suddenly, I discovered it was an extermination, not camp, but a continent of extermination. In East, they shot the Jews in public. Holocaust was in public. Secret was from West, but no secret in East. All the village was watching. All the neighbors were watching. They were poor people, and the Nazi, they used the Soviet system of requisition to force them to work. They were forced to dig the grave, to carry the Jews in cart with horses from the village to the mass grave, to fulfill the mass grave in night, to bring back the furniture of Jewish houses and to sell them, etc. And all these people who have been children forced by the Nazi, they want to speak today before to die.
Стоять в очередь, роздіваються наголо. Наголо все і стають.
Так де ті, можете нам показати, де ями ті знаходяться?
От в которых... тут, це ж оце ж яма. Мене розкупали були на них. Я розтирався. Думаю, що ж, яке гляну, а там таке робилося, таке, що страшно. То мені щось таке зробили, що мені мову одебрало.
You know, 60 years after, they still remember the last words of the dead people. They kept this secret. One woman told me, Father, I was dreaming all my life to find somebody to say that.
Ні, винтовки такі, от, ну, перший випуск винтовок.
Винтовки?
З штиками такі, от, не добив, штиком штурхнув, кинув яму. Страх Божий.
Попрощались со всеми, розплакались. Ми з їхніми дітьми, от були маленькі діти, я знаю, Давид.
We know I don't come to judge. I come to know the truth, to establish the evidences because of the deniers, and also to find back the corpse so they will receive a prayer and a dignity. If I don't do it, who will do it?
Many will say it took a Catholic priest to travel all the way to the Ukraine and to unlock these memories and to locate and identify these graves. There are literally millions of people who are unnamed and whose graves are unmarked, for whom Patrick Desbois has carried out a kind of sacred mission to identify their final resting place.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website. Audio and video podcasts are also available. And because our website is a finalist for a prestigious Webby Award from the International Academy of Digital Arts and Sciences, you can find a link to vote for us. This is the last week you can do that. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from the Holocaust Remembrance Ceremony at the Capitol.